This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Saddam Hussein is still in power. In spite of the Gulf War, subsequent coup attempts, U.S. spies serving on U.N. weapons inspection teams, and continued Allied bombings, including three raids yesterday. Patrick and Alexandra Coburn investigate how Saddam has managed to survive in their new book, Out of the Ashes, The Resurrection of Saddam Hussein. Today, the New York Times reports that a forthcoming book by a former U.N. weapons inspector claims that the CIA had spies working on U.N. weapons inspection teams earlier than had previously been reported, and those agents may have been connected to a failed coup attempt in 1996. The Coburns say that their understanding is that the involvement of these agents in the planning of the coup, if any, was minimal. My guest, Patrick Coburn, is senior Middle East correspondent for the London Independent, a position he formerly held at the Financial Times. He remained in Baghdad during the Gulf War and was last there during the December Allied bombings. I spoke with him Thursday, shortly before he returned to his base in Jerusalem. He told me that he's pessimistic that bombing Iraq will end Saddam Hussein's regime.
Well, the biggest bombing of Iraq was in 1991. And we all know that that wholly failed to end the regime. The bombing we saw last December, I was in Baghdad, was much smaller on scale than, in scale than we saw then. So it's very unlikely that this will end the regime. The Iraqis are quite used to being bombed. You see on television big ministerial buildings being hit, but usually they're empty, they've been evacuated. It really doesn't hit the heart of the regime. And even during 91, I was told by when it was very heavy bombing over a long period, I was told by the head of Iraqi military intelligence, who's now in exile, that they lost no officer over the rank of a brigadier.
Well, you point out in your book that the infrastructure that supports Saddam Hussein's regime is the people, not the buildings. Saddam Hussein has managed to stay hidden during all of the bombing last year and in previous years. How does Saddam Hussein stay hidden? What do you know about his secret whereabouts?
That's a good question. I mean, during the original bombing and I think during the last one too, one place, I mean, a senior Iraqi officer told me that they weren't was inside a deep bunker, because they thought that the Allies, the U.S., Britain, knew where these bunkers were. What he normally does is stay very mobile. He stays in suburban houses. He shifts his address very often. He doesn't tell anybody where he is. He moves around Baghdad in an old car with one bodyguard, although there are other bodyguards further out, but he doesn't want to identify who or where he is by a great big convoy with lots of armed men around. And if any other senior official wants to get in touch with him, you can't ring him up direct. You ring up his office, and then you get rung back from another location. Or sometimes he just turns up in person. So the number of people who know where he is in Baghdad at any one time is very limited.
Do you think he uses disguises when he's going from one place to another?
He has doubles to confuse the issue. People who look like him, people who've been trained to behave like him. But it's more, the disguise is more the vehicles he uses, the place he stays. He doesn't alter his appearance. And I met one Iraqi recently who was just driving through the traffic a couple of years ago. He looked up and in the car beside him, there was Saddam Hussein driving himself. That doesn't mean he's isolated. There are bodyguards there, but there aren't a bunch of people in uniform which make his position identifiable.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Patrick Coburn. He's senior Middle East correspondent for the London Independent, co-author of the new book, Out of the Ashes, The Resurrection of Saddam Hussein. There have been several attempts to overthrow Saddam Hussein. The CIA has been involved in a couple of them. What do you consider to be the largest, most ambitious attempt that the CIA was involved with?
It was in 1996. They had a very carefully organized attempt based in Jordan. They believed that they'd won over senior Iraqi officers right at the heart of Saddam's power. in his personal security, in his communications units. They were very confident. The opposition group they were backing, the Iraqi National Accord, was even giving interviews publicly saying that they were going to overthrow Saddam and do so quickly. Unfortunately, it seems that from the very beginning, this operation had been penetrated by Iraqi intelligence, that the Jordanian prime minister of the day, who was very much opposed to the regime in Iraq, told us that he thought that the Iraqis could always see them coming, that every move that was made by the opposition based in Jordan seemed to be known in Baghdad first. And they knew it because they'd intercepted the communications between Amman and Baghdad. And finally, they struck in the middle of 1996, and there were mass arrests, mass torturing, and mass executions. There are still people being executed. If you would see the lists of people who've been executed in Baghdad recently, there are still people being executed in over the last few months who are involved in this attempt.
What was the plan to overthrow Saddam?
It was to make a coup from the center. It's a regime which has focused power, particularly since the Gulf War, on around the person of Saddam, but is very dependent on the inner presidential security, the special Republican Guard units, the inner family. They thought if they could strike right at the center, then they could begin a military coup, and then the whole regime would begin to disintegrate. It was very much aimed at the top of the regime, and they felt that they had got the right officers in critical positions who would support them. Unfortunately, as I said, the Iraqis knew this from quite an early stage and knew every move that particularly the CIA station in Amman was making. And much to their astonishment, they suddenly saw this all disintegrate and all their people arrested.
What was the CIA's role in this coup? Was it just funding this opposition group, or was it actively helping to plan the coup? Was it leading the planning of it?
Yes. I mean, this was very much a hands-on operation and was in... were allied to other intelligence services, including the British. They had meetings with... they were closely associated with Jordanian intelligence, with Saudi intelligence. It was trying to pool resources to identify who in the inner elite in Baghdad they might be able to suborn to get to support them.
How do you as a journalist get, without betraying any sources, how do you as a journalist get information about a secret CIA coup attempt?
Well, after you have a disaster like this, there are casualties of the plot who survive. So there are people, Iraqis who are involved in it, who did manage to get out of the country, who one can talk to, who are well informed on what happened. Secondly, there are other opposition groups who knew about it but weren't closely associated with it, who have very precise information about what was going on. So it would be much more difficult to find out details of a successful plot, but when something goes seriously wrong, it's much easier to find people who will talk. Even so, it's not that easy, but we were able to find people.
Well, why is it easier to find out the people behind an unsuccessful coup?
Oh, because people have fled into exile. There are people whose relatives have been killed, people who are very angry, and people who want to blame others on over what happened. They have In some cases, they think would have been organized in a slightly different way, it might have been successful. And some people are very bitter because their relatives have been arrested, tortured savagely, sometimes executed, sometimes have just disappeared.
My guest is Patrick Coburn. He's the co-author of the new book, Out of the Ashes, The Resurrection of Saddam Hussein. Coburn is senior Middle East correspondent for the London Independent. Let's take a break here, and then we'll talk some more about Saddam Hussein and how he's managed to stay in power for so long. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Patrick Coburn, co-author of the new book, Out of the Ashes, The Resurrection of Saddam Hussein. He's senior Middle East correspondent for the London Independent. There was an underground opposition group called El Nada. Am I saying that right?
El Nada, yeah.
In English, that means the awakening. Mm. And you write about how they tried to assassinate Saddam Hussein's oldest son, Uday. They managed to shoot him 8 times, but he survived. Why did they choose him, Saddam's oldest son, as the target?
They decided that there were the four most important people in the regime were Saddam, his 2 sons, Uday and Tuzai, and a cousin of his, Ali Hassan al-Majid. They then looked at who would be the easiest to attack. Saddam, very difficult because he's always moving around, very heavy security. Tuzai, the other son, keeps a low profile. The cousin also. They thought Uday, who's a playboy, flamboyant, would be the easiest to find and the easiest person to get information about. So they decided to target him.
Well, say they had succeeded in killing him, would that have toppled the regime? What impact could that have had?
It would have had an impact, and it did have an impact, the fact they'd shot him, because despite everything that had happened, the elite of the regime, the inner core, had gave to Iraqis a sense that they were invulnerable, despite everything that happened, wars, defeats in wars, conspiracies, plots, nobody had ever got to them. So what they wanted to do was to show that the regime was not invulnerable, and they also wanted to show that Iraqis themselves inside the country, not a foreign-directed plot, could do something against the regime. Ordinary Iraqis often have a sense of impotence, political impotence. They feel the whole time they're the victims, but they're watching a battle which affects their lives between Saddam, the regime, and its many enemies outside the country. They wanted to show that ordinary Iraqis could do something, and they succeeded in doing that.
Uday, Saddam's eldest son, seems like a particularly scary figure. You describe him as a playboy who revered Western taste and culture. A few years ago, he murdered one of his father's closest aides.
Yes, he murdered Hannah Jarjo, who's his father's close aide, food taster. It was over a dispute within the family. Saddam had taken a mistress. His wife, Sajida, was very angry, was close to Uday. There was a party on an island in the center of Baghdad. Uday drinks very heavily. His mother and others were at one party. Uday decided to hold a party next door. He got very drunk and had a quarrel with Jarjo, this close aide of his father, and killed him.
No, Uday Saddam's oldest son also murdered 2 of his brothers-in-law, yes?
Yes, I mean, when Hussein Kamel, who was married to one of his sisters and his brother married to another sister, fled to Jordan, and there's no doubt that they were frightened of Uday. They were competing with him in business. They were scared of him. This was one of the reasons that they fled to Jordan.
I know for a while Uday was the head of Iraqi media. Does he still hold that position?
He's influential, but not quite as he was before. He was very badly wounded. I mean, the bottom half of his body. He was in a car when he was shot. It was somebody leaning forward and downwards, pumping bullets into him at close range. So he's very badly injured. He's not sexually impotent, as a lot of Iraqis believed at the time. But
this was an issue because he was such a playboy.
Yeah, I think people kind of wanted to believe it because they felt that there was a certain sort of justice in the idea that somebody who'd been known for raping women should now that be unable to have no sex life at all. But it's not true.
Did you ever have to deal with him directly since he was the head of Iraqi media?
We met him at one stage and had dinner with him, in which we should say he behaved very well. He speaks good English. And you don't meet him directly because of his control of the media. It's done through other people. He doesn't come out and make statements. You can work out what's in his mind because you know that he will have determined what appears, and he has one paper, for instance, called Babel, his television channels and other things. He would tell the editor what to write. Occasionally, he wouldn't then forget what he'd said to the editor, and the editor would be thrown in prison or lashed. And for aides to Uday, he used to keep tape recorders in their pockets when he gave them any order, as a sort of defense, if afterwards he said, why did you write this or why did you say this? And they'd say, well, you told me to. And then he'd say, well, no, I didn't. So they always had these tape recorders with them to play back what their orders in a desperate, not always very successful attempt to avoid severe punishment.
Is it a funny feeling to be sitting down with someone who's such a tyrant, part of a tyrannical regime, and having a nice civil dinner?
Oh, sure, yes. Because with you don't know how these people are going to react. I mean, they're friendly at one moment, but you know their track record.
Mm-hmm. They know yours. I mean, I'm sure they know how you feel about their regime. They've probably read your stuff.
Well, I was kind of hoping not too closely. And you don't know how much they read. I mean, it's peculiar being a journalist there. I mean, last year I was summoned to the Ministry of Information twice. And I was a bit worried as to what they were going to complain about. But what they focus on most of all is any criticism of Saddam himself. And I'd written a number of things which I thought they really wouldn't like at all about various plots and to be executed. But in fact, one of the things that irritated them was that I'd written an article comparing Saddam Hussein to Shakespeare's Richard III, who had also had a very bloody career and killed his two nephews and so forth. And they didn't like this at all, this rather, I thought, amusing historical parallel, because of this particular king, you may recall, only lasted 3 years. Saddam's lasted 30. But they objected strongly to that. So sometimes it's something very serious, and sometimes it's very trivial. I also kept in mind that the last British journalist to be arrested and jailed there was hanged. So that never leaves your mind either.
So what do you do when they criticize this piece? Are you supposed to apologize or what?
No. I mean, I said, well, I said, look, this is Shakespeare. It's a respectable historical parallel. That's what I wrote. And so, no, I didn't apologize. And they didn't carry it forward after that.
Has a chilling effect?
Oh, yes, And you should be chilled by this. I mean, sometimes people arrive in Baghdad and they feel it's not as bad as it looks, but you always got to be, anybody with any sense is very wary there.
So listen, getting back to that dinner for a second, I have to ask, who picked up the tab, you or Uday?
I think there was some confusion of the bill afterwards. It's quite difficult to pay with these people. I mean, I think it was on the hotel bill eventually.
Right, people don't charge Uday, I guess.
Yeah, it's not a big issue at the end of dinners like that. You don't sort of sit there glancing at your watch, wondering where the bill is, and seeing if you've been ever charged or anything.
All right. Patrick Coburn is co-author of Out of the Ashes, The Resurrection of Saddam Hussein. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, with more of our interview with Patrick Coburn, co-author with his brother Andrew of the new book Out of the Ashes, The Resurrection of Saddam Hussein. Patrick Coburn is senior Middle East correspondent for the London Independent. The Allies are continuing to bomb Iraq. Yesterday, U.S. and British warplanes conducted 3 raids. Do you think that we're basically engaged in a low-level war with Iraq now?
Yes, I think that's quite a good way of describing it. I mean, we now have pretty well daily bombings by U.S. and British aircraft of Iraqi positions. We had big bombing in December, but it's all escalating. And there's always a chance that it could escalate very fast. I mean, either a plane gets shot down or a plane crashes for operational reasons, I mean, for just by accident, and then it could escalate once again. So the pot is boiling more and more, and there's always a chance it's going to overboil. And then, to my mind, it's almost inevitable it will overboil.
And then what?
Then we'll see. I mean, one of the problems is that even this low-level war doesn't... It may wound the regime a little, but it doesn't come close to overthrowing it. There was a chance to overthrow it at the end of the Gulf War. George Bush, for not bad reasons, decided that they wouldn't push on to Baghdad. The Gulf War was really a very conservative war to return the Middle East to what it had been before the invasion of Kuwait. He felt he didn't have a mandate. And these were not unreasonable things. But I think it's a mistake to try to get concessions from Iraq that you can only get if you've wholly defeated somebody in a war, which they failed to do. At some point, there should be an agreement which concludes the Gulf War. Sanctions were one way, which described him Washington as keeping Saddam in his box. The problem is that 22 million Iraqis were also in the same box, and they suffered more than Saddam. It was very much a shotgun approach. If there's to be any end to this conflict, other than the whole regime disintegrating or being overthrown, which people have been trying to do for a long time now and hasn't happened, I think it has to be much more focused on, for instance, not overall sanctions against the country, but very tight restrictions on weapons or the materials to make weapons being brought into the country, inspection of existing facilities in there. That would really limit the offensive capability of the regime. Otherwise, the real casualties of all this are ordinary Iraqis.
You were in Iraq during the December bombing. Where did you stay?
I stayed in the Al Rashid Hotel, which is the big hotel which is normally used by journalists there. It's it has a number of advantages, one of which it has a continual, it has its own big generators. So it seemed possible during the bombing that they'd hit the power stations or the power lines as they did in 91. If you're staying in a place which is dependent on general power, then suddenly the elevators don't work, the lights go out, you can't work. So there aren't too many places where you guarantee that the building is probably going to go on functioning.
It must be so surreal when you're at the Al Rashid Hotel to know that, you know, the missiles are coming into the city. The anti-aircraft fire is exploding in the air, and there's like a press conference going on the roof. Oh, you know, all the cameras are on the roof shooting it. You know, it's being televised live around the world on CNN. it's so bizarre.
It is bizarre, and it's almost a new type of warfare, which is sort of deceptive, because you see on camera, and night vision equipment often even exaggerates the amount of light, because it that is coming from the anti-aircraft going up, that you see these great explosions, and it often exaggerates the extent of the bombardment. It did this in 91 as well, because people don't realize that Baghdad is a very big city. It's a very flat city. It extends a long way. So it looks as though this is a total destruction of the city. It isn't. I mean, it's quite heavy. But it gives a slightly deceptive feel to how badly the Iraqi government or Iraqis in general are being hit.
Where did you position yourself during the bombing in December?
I was around town. The bombing took place at night. The Iraqis had very tight security. You could see at crossroads, army, Mukhabarat, that's secret police, Ba'ath Party, the ruling party, with their submachine guns. You see the little Yugoslav submachine guns and Kalashnikovs, civil police at all the intersections. The whole town closed down, so there are very few people on the streets. What they liked you to do was to be on the Ministry of Information roof, where the television cameras were, but you could also see it from the hotel or wherever you were. Some places you could go to afterwards, which had been hit, or you could see it from the road. Some places that they kept you well back.
So did you stay on the roof, stay in your room?
I did both. I mean, I on the roof of the, on top of, I mean, on the upper stories of the hotel, on the roof. I also sort of drove around a bit.
At night?
Yeah.
You felt safe doing that?
No. I'm not safe for two reasons. One, you think the percentage chances of being hit are pretty small, but when you're driving around, you sort of, somehow, you don't feel that safe. The other thing is, what always happens with bombing, I've seen in other places that are being shelled, is that anybody who's driving on the streets starts driving like crazy. They don't obviously stop at traffic lights. They don't stop at intersections. So actually, in reality, there's probably a greater chance of being hit by another car.
What about all the armed guards?
There are the armed guards there. I always tried to get, I had a driver to drive slowly for two reasons. One, that I could see some other cars were rocketing around. And if they hit you, this is going to be really serious. Secondly, if you don't see guards at an intersection and you're driving fast, you could drive straight through them just by accident. And again, that'd be very dangerous because they might open fire.
Right. Do you think of Saddam Hussein as being brilliant in his paranoia?
Yeah, that's well put. There is a brilliance there. He's extraordinarily clever in terms of Iraqi politics, internal politics, of balancing the different factions, of creating multiple loyalties, by which I mean somebody might be loyal to him for tribal reasons, or because they're a member of the party, or because they've received money, or they're part of his family, to prevent anybody uniting behind him. And this is what makes it so difficult to deal with Iraq or predict policy, that at various moments he seems extraordinarily subtle and cunning, but with a great capacity to overplay his hand when things are going well for him. I think partly was nobody around him really dares ever contradict him. I remember one Russian diplomat in Baghdad who'd had a lot of dealings with the leadership, and I said, well, what about the sort of the more so-called more liberal members of the elite, like Tariq Aziz, who often acts as the spokesman? And he said, well, look, the only safe thing to do if you're meeting with Saddam and you're part of his entourage is to be 10% tougher than the boss. You kind of work out what they say, what they do would be work out in their mind what the boss's policy was, what Saddam's policy was, and then sort of reiterate that with 10% more. So he's not a man who necessarily gets good advice. He also is somebody who doesn't know the outside world, so his grossest errors were attacking Iran in 1980 and attacking Kuwait in 1990. And the two decisions have a lot in parallel, that he had a sense that he was in a strong position, but he exaggerated the strength, and both brought disaster.
Well, Patrick Cockburn, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
No, thank you. Enjoy.
Patrick Cockburn is the co-author of Out of the Ashes, The Resurrection of Saddam Hussein. Our interview was recorded Thursday during his visit to the U.S. This is Fresh Air.